Chapter 3. New Albany, Indiana, June 1857. The mists were thick on the river and the air damp and chilly. It was just after midnight when Joshua York, finally arrived from St. Louis, met Abner Marsh in the deserted boatyards of New Albany. Marsh had been waiting for almost half an hour when York appeared, striding out of the fog like some pale apparition. Behind him, silent as shadows, came four others. Marsh grinned toothily. "Joshua," he said. He nodded curtly to the others. He had met them briefly back in April in St. Louis, before he had taken passage to New Albany to supervise the building of his dream. They were York's friends and travelling companions, but another bunch Marsh had never met. Two of them were men of indeterminate age with foreign names that he could neither remember nor pronounce. He called them Smith and Brown, to York's amusement. They were always yapping at each other in some outlandish gibble-gabble. The third man, a hollow-cheeked Easterner who dressed like a mortician, was called Simon and never spoke at all. The woman, Catherine, was said to be a Britisher. She was tall and kind of stooped, with a sickly, decaying look to her. She reminded Marsh of a great white vulture. But she was York's friend, all of them were, and York had warned him that he might have peculiar friends, so Abner Marsh held his tongue. "Good evening, Abner," York said. He stopped and glanced around the yards where the half-built steamers lay like so many skeletons amid the grey, flowing mists. "Cold night, isn't it? For June."
"That it is. You come far?"
"I've taken a suite at the Galt House over in Louisville. We hired a boat to take us across the river." His cool grey eyes studied the nearest steamboat with interest.
"Is this one ours?"
Marsh snorted.
"This little thing? Hell no! That's just some cheap sternwheeler they're building for the Cincinnati trade. You don't think I'd put no damned sternwheel on our boat, do you?"
York smiled. "Forgive my ignorance. Where is our boat, then?"
"Come this way,"
Marsh said, gesturing broadly with his walking stick. He led them half across the boatyard.
"There,"
he said, pointing. The mists gave way for them, and there she stood, high and proud, dwarfing all the other boats around her. Her cabins and rails gleamed with fresh paint, pale as snow, bright even in the grey shroud of fog. Way up on her Texas roof, halfway to the stars, her pilot house seemed to glitter. A glass temple, its ornate cupola decorated all around with fancy woodwork as intricate as Irish lace. Her chimneys, twin pillars that stood just forward of the Texas deck, rose up 100 feet, black and straight and haughty. Their feathered tops bloomed like two dark metal flowers. Her hull was slender and seemed to go on forever with her stern obscured by the fog. Like all the first-class boats, she was a side-wheeler. Set amidship, the huge curved wheelhouses loomed gigantic, hinting at the vast power of the paddle wheels concealed within them. They seemed all the larger for want of the name that would soon be emblazoned across them. In the night and the fog, amid all those smaller, plainer boats, she seemed a vision. A white phantom from some riverman's dream. She took the breath away, Marsh thought as they stood there. Smith was gibbling and Brown was gabbling back at him, but Joshua York just looked. For the longest time he looked, and then he nodded. "We have created something beautiful, Abner," he said. Marsh smiled. "I had not expected to find her so close to finished," York said.
"This is New Albany," said Marsh. "That's why I came here, instead of one of the boatyards in St. Louis. They've been building steamboats here since I was a boy. Built 22 of them just last year. Probably have almost that many this year. I knew they could do the job for us. You should have been here. I came in with one of those little chests of gold, and I dumped it all over the superintendent's desk, and I says to him, I says, 'I want a steamer built, and I want it built quick, and I want it to be the fastest and prettiest and best damn heller of a boat that you ever damn built, you hear?' Now you get me some engineers, your best. I don't care if you got to drag them out of some cat house over to Louisville. You get them to me tonight so we can begin. And you get me the best damn carpenters and painters and boilermakers and all the damn rest. Because if I get anything but the best, you're going to be a mighty sorry man."
Marsh laughed.
"Hey, you should have seen him. Didn't know whether to look at that gold or listen to me. Both scared him half to death. But he did us right, that he did."
He nodded toward the boat.
"Of course she's not finished. Trim needs to be painted. Going to do it up mostly in blue and silver to go with all that silver you wanted in the saloon. And we're still waiting on some of the fancy furniture and mirrors you ordered from Philadelphia and such things. But mostly she's done, Joshua. Mostly she's ready. Come, I'll show you.
Workmen had abandoned a lantern atop a pile of lumber near the stern of the boat. Marsh struck a match on his leg, lit the lantern, and thrust it imperiously at Brown.
Here, you carry this, he said brusquely.
He went clomping heavily up a long board onto the main deck, the others trailing behind.
Careful what you touch, he said. Some of the paint's still wet.
The lowest or main deck was full of machinery. The lantern burned with a clear, steady light, but Brown kept moving it around so the shadows of the hulking machine seemed to shift and jump ominously, as if they were things alive.
Here, hold that still, Marsh commanded.
He turned to York and began to point, his stick jabbing like a long hickory finger toward the boilers, great metal cylinders that ran along either side of the forepart of the deck.
18 boilers, Marsh said proudly. 3 more than the Eclipse. 38-inch diameters, 28 foot long, each of them.
His stick waggled.
Furnaces are all done up with fire brick and sheet iron. Got them up in brackets, clear of the deck, cuts down on the chance of fires.
He traced the path of the steam lines overhead, running from the boilers back to the engines, and they all turned towards the stern.
We got 36-inch cylinders, high pressure, and we got ourselves an 11-foot stroke, same as the Eclipse. This boat is gonna chew up that old river something terrible, I tell you.
Brown gabbled, Smith gibbled, and Joshua York smiled.
Come on up, Marsh said. Your friends don't seem too interested in the engines, but they ought to like it just fine upstairs.
The staircase was wide and ornate, polished oak with graceful fluted banisters. It began up near the bow, its width hiding the boilers and engines from those boarding, then broke in two and curled gracefully to either side to open on the second or boiler deck. They walked along the starboard side, with Marsh and his stick and Brown and the lantern leading the way, their boots clacking on the hardwood deck of the promenade, as they marvelled at the fine Gothic detail of the pillars and the guardrails, all the painstakingly shaped wood carved with flowers and curlicues and acorns. Stateroom doors and windows ran fore and aft in a long, long row. The doors were dark walnut, the windows stained glass.
"Staterooms aren't furnished yet," Marsh said, opening a door and leading them into one. "But we're getting nothing but the best. Feather beds and feather pillows, a mirror and an oil lamp for each room. Our cabins are larger than usual, too. Won't be able to take quite as many passengers as some other boat our size, but they'll have more room." He smiled. "We can charge them more, too."
Each cabin had two doors, one leading out onto the deck, the other inward to the grand saloon, the main cabin of the steamer.
"Main cabin isn't near finished," Marsh said. "But come look at it anyway."
They entered and stopped, while Brown raised the lantern to cast light all up and down the vast, echoing length of it. The grand saloon extended the length of the boiler deck, continuous and unobstructed except by a midship gangway.
"Foreportion is the gents' cabin, aft for the ladies," Marsh explained. "Take a look. Ain't done yet, but she'll be something. That marble bar there is 40 foot long, and we're going to put a mirror behind it just as big. Got it on order now. We'll have mirrors on every stateroom door, too, with silver frames around them, and a 12-foot-high mirror there, at the aft end of the ladies' cabin."
He pointed upward with his stick.
"Can't see nothing now with it being dark and all, but the skylights are stained glass, run the whole length of the cabin. We're going to put down one of them Brussels carpets, and carpets in all the staterooms, too. We got a silver water cooler with silver cups that's going to stand on a fancy wooden table, and we got a grand piano and brand new velvet chairs and real linen tablecloths. None of it's here yet, though."
Even empty of carpeting, mirrors, and furniture, the long cabin had a splendour to it. They walked down it slowly, in silence, and in the moving light of the lantern, bits of its stately beauty suddenly took form from the darkness, only to vanish again behind them. The high-arched ceiling with its curving beams, carved and painted with detail as fine as fairy lace. Long rows of slim columns flanking the stateroom doors, trimmed with delicate fluting. The black marble bar with its thick veins of colour, the oily sheen of dark wood, the double row of chandeliers, each with 4 great crystal globes hanging from a spider-web of wrought iron, wanting only oil and a flame and all those mirrors to wake the whole saloon to glorious, glittering light.
"I thought the cabin's too small," Catherine said suddenly.
but this room will be grand. Marsh frowned at her.
Cabins are big, ma'am. 8 foot square. 6 as usual. This is a steamer, you know.
He turned away from her, pointed with his walking stick.
Clerk's office will be all the way forward there. The kitchen and the washrooms are by the wheelhouses. I know just the cook I want to get to. Used to work on my Lady Liz.
The roof of the boiler deck was the hurricane deck. They walked up a narrow stair and emerged forward of the great black iron smokestacks, then up a shorter stair to the Texas deck, which ran back from the stacks to the wheelhouses.
Crew's cabins,
Marsh said, not bothering with the tour. The pilot house stood atop the Texas. He led them up and in. From here, the whole yards were visible. All the lesser boats wrapped in mist, the black waters of the Ohio River beyond, and even the distant lights of Louisville, ghostly flickers in the fog. The interior of the pilot house was large and plush. The windows were of the best and clearest glass, with stained glass trim around them. Everywhere shone dark wood and polished silver, pale and cold in the lantern light. And there was the wheel. Only the top half of it was visible, so huge was it, and even that stood as high as Marsh himself, while the bottom half was set in a slot in the floorboards. It was fashioned of soft black teak, cool and smooth to the touch, and the spokes were ornamental silver bands like a dance hall girl wears garters. The wheel seemed to cry out for a pilot's hands. Joshua York came up to the wheel and touched it, running a pale hand over the black wood and silver. Then he took hold of it, as if he were a pilot himself, and for a long moment he stood like that, the wheel in his hands and his grey eyes brooding as they stared out into the night and the unseasonable June fog. The others all fell silent, and for a brief moment Abner Marsh could almost feel the steamboat move over some dark river of the mind, on a voyage strange and endless. Joshua York turned then and broke the spell. "Abner," he said, "I would like to learn to steer this boat. Can you teach me to pilot?"
"Pilot, eh?" Marsh said, surprised.
He had no difficulty imagining York as a master and a captain, but piloting was something else. Yet somehow the very asking made him warm to his partner, made him understandable after all. Abner Marsh knew what it was to want to pilot.
"Well, Joshua," he said, "I've done my share of piloting, and it's the grandest feeling in the world. Being a captain, that ain't nothing to piloting. But it ain't something you just pick up, if you know what I'm saying."
"The wheel looks simple enough to master," York said. Marsh laughed.
"Hell yes, but it's not the wheel you gotta learn. It's the river, York, the river. The old Mississippi itself. I was a pilot for 8 years before I got my own boats, licensed for the upper Mississippi and the Illinois. Never for the Ohio, though, or the lower Mississippi. And for all I knew about steamboating, I couldn't have piloted no boat on those rivers to save my life. Didn't know 'em. Those I did know took me years to learn them, and the learning never stopped. By now I've been at the pilot house for so long that I'd have to learn them all over again. The river changes, Joshua, that it does. Ain't never the same twice in a row, and you've got to know every inch of it."
Marsh strolled to the wheel and put one of his own hands on it fondly.
"Now I plan to pilot this boat at least once. I dreamed about her too long not to want to take her in my hands. When we go against the Eclipse, I mean to stand a spell in the pilot house, that I do. But she's too grand a boat for anything but the New Orleans trade, and that means the lower river. So I'm going to have to start learning myself, learn every damn foot. Takes time, takes work."
He looked at York.
"You still want a pilot, now you know what it means?"
"We can learn together, Abner," York replied. York's companions were growing restless. They wandered from window to window, Brown shifting the lantern from one hand to the other, Simon as grim as a cadaver. Smith said something to York in their foreign tongue. York nodded. "We must be going back," he said. Marsh glanced around one final time, reluctant to leave even now, and led them from the pilot house. When they had trudged partway through the boatyards, York turned and looked back towards their steamboat where she sat on her pilings, pale against the darkness. The other stopped as well and waited silently.
"Do you know Byron?"
York asked Marsh. Marsh thought a minute.
"Know a fella named Black Jack Pete, used to pilot on the Grand Turk. I think his last name was Brian."
York smiled. "Not Brian, Byron. Lord Byron, the English poet."
"Oh," said Marsh. "Him. I'm not much of a one for poems. I think I heard of him, though. Gimp, wasn't he? And quite a one for the ladies."
The very one, Abner. An astounding man. I had the good fortune to meet him once. Our steamboat put me in mind of a poem he once wrote. He began to recite. She walks in beauty like the night, of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes, thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies. Byron wrote of a woman, of course, but the words seem to fit our boat as well, do they not? Look at her, Abner. What do you think? Abner Marsh didn't quite know what to think. Your average steamboat man didn't go around spouting poetry, and he didn't know what to say to one who did.
Very interesting, Joshua, was all he managed.
What shall we name her? York asked, his eyes still fixed on the boat and a slight smile on his face. Does the poem suggest anything? Marsh frowned.
We're not going to name her after any gimp Britisher, if that's what you're thinking, he said gruffly.
No, said York. I wasn't suggesting that. I had in mind something like Dark Lady, or...
I had something in mind myself, Marsh said. We're Fever River packets, after all, and this boat is all I ever dreamed come true.
He lifted his hickory stick and pointed at the wheelhouse.
We'll put it right up there, big blue and silver letters, real fancy. Fever Dream, he smiled. Fever Dream against the eclipse. They'll talk about that race till all of us are dead.
For a moment, something strange and haunted moved in Joshua York's grey eyes. Then it was gone as swiftly as it had come. Fever Dream, he said. Don't you think that choice a bit, ominous?
It suggests sickness to me, fever and death and twisted visions. Dreams that should not be dreamed, Abner.
Marsh frowned.
I don't know about that. I like it.
Will people ride in a boat with such a name? Steamboats have been known to carry typhoid and yellow fever. Do we wish to remind them of such things?
They rode my sweet fever, Marsh said. They ride the War Eagle and the Ghost. Even boats named after Red Indians, they'd ride her.
The gaunt, pale one named Simon said something then, in a voice that rasped like a rusty saw and a language strange to Marsh, though it was not the one Smith and Brown babbled in. York heard him, and his face took on a thoughtful cast, though it still seemed troubled. Fever Dream, he said again. I had hoped for a
healthier name, but Simon has made a point to me. Have your way then, Abner. The Fever Dream she is. Good, Marsh said.
York nodded absently.
Let us meet tomorrow for dinner at the Gault House, at 8. We can make plans for our voyage to St. Louis, discuss crew and provisioning, if that is agreeable to you.
Marsh voiced a gruff assent, and York and his companions went off toward their boat, vanishing into the mists. Long after they had gone, Marsh stood in the boatyards, staring at the still, silent steamer.
Fever Dream, he said loudly,
just to test the taste of the words on his tongue. But oddly, for the first time the name seemed wrong in his ears, fraught with connotations he did not like. He shivered unaccountably cold for a moment, then snorted and set off for bed.